and very happy to be back at Perimeter. And I'm also very happy to be addressing both the string theory group and the quantum gravity group at Perimeter. And I should say that my talk today doesn't have anything to do with string theory, nothing to do with string theory. Although it's true that many of the ideas involved historically were developed using the tools of string theory. But this set of ideas has really reached a level of maturity where it's possible to really sort of prove non-trivial results and learn some interesting things just using the ideas themselves, ideas of holography and unitarity and so forth, with no reference whatsoever to the string theoretic origin of these ideas historically, except maybe we can refer back to string theory as a set of examples sometimes if we'd like to. But so what I'm going to talk about today is a set of a particular fact about quantum gravity. So the thing I'll tell you today is a fact, which is to say a theorem. Something which can be proven rigorously. Under some very mild assumptions, rigorously and model independently. So, no assumptions. No assumptions about a specific dynamical model. And finally, what I'm going to tell you, what maybe distinguishes this result a little bit from the sorts of things you might have that this might remind you of, is that it's non-asymptotic. So it's a theorem which does not refer to a limit. So for instance, it's not like it's not something that will tell you about an asymptotic density of states in quantum gravity. It'll tell you about specific states, finite amounts of information, some specific information about the spectrum of quantum gravity. In the most general case. So in particular, I'll tell you what it is. So it's a general upper bound in three dimensions, I'll talk at the end about how these techniques ought to be extendable to higher dimensions, but there are both technical and conceptual challenges to doing this. But I'm going to try to show you. I mean, three dimensions is certainly easier. We all know that three dimensions is easier than other dimensions, but still, it's not as easy as it's not easy for the reasons you think. Okay, so general upper bound on the what I call M1, which is to say the mass of the lightest massive state. In any theory of quantum gravity, with a finite Newton constant. And a cosmological constant that's non-positive. Well, let's say negative, but I'll try to convince you that it also applies to Minkowski space. So now some of you may be saying, well, why is this non-trivial? We all know the spectrum of quantum gravity in three dimensions, and in particular. So pure quantum gravity in three dimensions. Well, first of all, different people mean different things by pure quantum gravity in three dimensions. So you can imagine the quantum gravity in three dimensions, which contains only the metric. R, which is scalar, plus 2 L squared, and cosmological constant. You could imagine a theory like that, with where you just said by fiat that there were no black holes. Okay, so this theory, as we know, doesn't have any bulk excitations. It doesn't have any local degrees of freedom. For a negative cosmological constant, it only has boundary metric excitations. I'll call them gravitons. I hope everyone will understand in this talk that whenever I say gravitons, I'm always going to be referring to boundary metric excitations in three dimensions, which aren't really like gravitons. They don't radiate or propagate in the bulk, but it's just for brevity. I'll use the word. Okay, so you might imagine such a theory, and then there would be no massive states whatsoever. There would only be gravitational excitations, graviton excitations. So one of the things I'll tell you about today is that this theory doesn't exist under some mild assumptions. Now, many people believe that already. It's not terribly earth-shattering. Okay. You could also imagine a theory that has only black holes. So in this case, the bound would give a lower bound on the mass of the lightest black hole. But that's also pretty trivial, because we'll see that this bound for small cosmological constant just agrees more or less exactly. Well, does agree exactly in the limit with the what we already knew, the mass of the lightest BTZ black hole, which is 1/4 g Newton. So you might be saying, well, so why is there anything non-trivial? We know what 3D quantum gravity is. It has to be one of these things. But when I say quantum gravity, I really mean any quantum theory containing gravity. So the theorem I'll prove includes quantum gravity plus matter. And I really mean dynamical matter. Fields, scalar fields, fermions, gauge fields, etc. Strings, if you like, doesn't have to be. The strings, brains, anything. So we're going to prove an upper bound on the mass of the lightest state in this completely general case. So you might say, well, classically, you know that the BTZ black hole always exists, that the lightest BTZ black hole always exists at mass equals 1 over 4 g Newton. But we know that there are quantum corrections in the case where there's matter. And using field theoretic reasoning, we don't really have any way to control them. So for finite lambda, there exists a sort of a finite volume corrections. And for finite, let's say, a mass of a matter times g Newton. So when the matter has finite mass and Planck units, there are just ordinary loop corrections, okay, which are not small for the smallest BTZ black hole. So one has loops of matter renormalizing the mass of the lightest black hole. Yeah. Well, there are always quantum corrections in general.
No, I mean for the BTZ black hole itself.
As a classical solution. As a classical solution in 3D gravity, one always has the BTZ black hole. That's all I mean. So you might say, okay, that's a candidate general upper bound for the mass of the lowest state. But it's not true in general. There are quantum corrections that could push the mass up.
The correction I was adding is that sometimes it's not a normalizable excitation of the vacuum, so it does not exist.
Right, okay, so and you might worry about that too. I think I covered that in the first thing you might think about. No black holes. You might say, well, it's not a state.
Yeah, what do you mean the theory does not exist? Do you mean it doesn't have a UV completion or as it state doesn't exist?
Yeah, I'll say it also doesn't have a UV completion under some assumptions. So now I'm going to talk about, I'll lay out explicitly what the assumptions are. You can, and I'll, you know, I'll try to motivate them. You can like or dislike them. It's fine. You can probably guess the assumption which, okay, so the key assumptions, but before I go into this, I just want to make sure that everyone understands the problem first, how to make some sort of falsifiable statement about quantum gravity in general, if all you know is the low energy effective theory. So, I mean, the effective theory is a good way to organize the space of possible quantum gravities. Its parameters of the effective theory are a natural coordinate space on the space of possible quantum gravities, right? Yeah.
So are you restricting yourself to a small cosmological constant?
Nope.
Talking about highly curved.
Nope. That's not what I mean. Nope. Not restricting myself. No restriction like that. Absolutely.
So your statement that quantum gravity doesn't exist up there. Also, you're not assuming that. At least in a theory that semi-classically would correspond.
Well, these statements are fuzzy. I'll make precise statements later. I mean, this is really motivation. The statements will be made sharper soon. But I do want everyone to get a feel for what's the kind of problem we're trying to address. How do you organize the space of quantum gravities and make some sort of general statements about them under simple assumptions. Okay. So the means of organizing quantum gravity that I'll be using today will be in terms of the effective theory, the parameters of the effective theory, and where, in particular, I'm going to be proving something about where the effective theory breaks down. I'm going to say there is a given a Planck constant and a cosmological constant, there is some energy E beyond which a theory of pure quantum gravity can never be extended. There are always new states above this energy, which I'll construct. Okay, so it's some general statement about quantum gravity, which is fully quantum, non-asymptotic, doesn't rely on any sort of perturbation theory, and can be falsified at finite energy. Okay, so this is the sort of thing I think everyone interested in quantum gravity might be interested in. So now I'll talk about my assumptions. Oh, yeah, so I just want to show my slides. This is really a Blackboard talk. I have some nice pictures I want to show you. So I'm going to be using, of course, the boundary description, which is our most robust tool. So the question is going to be, does the landscape of two-dimensional conformal field theory look like this? So this red line, by the way, corresponds to the mass of the BTZ black hole. So does it look like this, you know, where there's no sharp upper bound on delta 1, just some distribution of lowest masses? Delta 1, you can translate into the mass of the lightest massive state. So does the landscape look like this? There might just be no sharp upper bound at all. Well, so as a model calculation, we know that in the holomorphically factorized case, the landscape of 2D conformal field theory looks something like this. Okay. It's a very much more tightly organized space than the space of general CFT. So there are, you know, particular quantization conditions on the dimensions, and based on recent work of Witten and others, it's become very clear that there is something like an upper bound, something like the one we might be interested in. Although in the holomorphically factorized case, it turns out that there are always states half as heavy as the BTZ black hole. So there's a factor of two there, which was a bit of a puzzle referred to in Witten's paper.
Is it an assumption, or is it something you can almost prove?
Well, okay, so I'll get to it in my assumption, in my assumptions bit. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly we're going to be assuming ADS-CFT the whole way, but it's, I mean, I'm going to try to make the case. It's not much of an assumption. It's really a model-independent fact about quantum gravity. I'll say a few words about that. But so today we're going to show that the full landscape of two-dimensional CFT looks basically like this, where the red line is the mass of the BTZ black hole. We don't know actually if these blue dots, you know, the set of CFTs, really scrunch all the way up to the red line, so whether the bound is actually saturated or whether they lie, you know, somewhat below it, up at large central charge. We do know, however, that there's nothing that lies, I'm going to show there's nothing that lies above this red line in a general theory.
Does modular invariance indicate it?
Yeah, modular invariance is a part of this. So I'll talk about that. In fact, I'm going to start talking about it right now. So the first assumption is going to be unitarity. And I want to make clear what I mean. I really mean unitarity in the conventional channel, in the time sense. I've learned relatively recently that there's been interesting work done on radial quantization of gravity in ADS-3, where one talks about a Hilbert space of states on a radial slice of ADS. But that's not the sensing which I'm, and there's no reason quantum gravity has to be unitary in that channel. But in the conventional channel, with respect to time, I'm going to assume that quantum gravity is described by unitary evolution. Now, this is true in all really concrete and complete models we have, so I think it's a relatively mild assumption, though certainly there's been work on alternatives to that, but I'm going to assume it for today's talk. Number two, right, so I'm going to assume that ADS CFT is valid. I think this isn't really a very strong assumption. In Witten's 1998 paper, there was a set of arguments for it, which was essentially completely model independent, a model independent construction of ADS CFT, although it depended on some things like some sort of path integral representation of the bulk of some sort. So it may not be, you may quibble with it. Although I should say that in the three-dimensional, two-dimensional case, this idea is actually very much older and goes back to a paper by Brown and Pinot showing that states in ADS3 form a representation of the Virasoro algebra, which makes it almost a CFT. But there is another input, which is locality, which is not really locality on the boundary, does not really manifest from these considerations. But there's been recent interesting work by Laurent Friedel and others shoring up this aspect of it. So, but for now, again, I'm going to assume it. So all the machinery of a CFT, we have OBE, OBEs, can be defined in a general conformal metric, etc. The usual axioms of CFT. And number three, sometimes this is included in two, but I want to just state it separately. Modular invariance. So I am going to assume modular invariance. I think it's a fairly weak assumption. If one doesn't assume that the CFT is modular invariant, one really gets many exotic phenomena, non-locality in the bulk at parametrically long distances. So it's in order to recover conventional bulk physics. It seems quite reasonable to assume modular invariance, and I'm going. But now, based on these things, I'm going to show you I'm going to derive.
Are you making some kind of Euclidean postulate, or is it that things
no.
have to come from Euclidean?
No. I mean, no. I mean, I'm going to define a partition function. Oh, yeah, maybe I should put in separately number four. I'll assume, this is actually even stronger than we need, but I'll assume a discrete operator spectrum. We don't even really need that much. But just for convenience, let's assume that. And then the partition function is always well defined. You don't even have to represent the partition function as Euclidean path integral if you don't want.
Well, the modular invariant in the Euclidean symmetry is somewhat weird.
Yeah, of course. It's obviously most convenient to think about it in those terms. But I mean, if you assume modular invariance, that's it. You have it. Yeah, these assumptions very naturally go together. I just want to really lay out what I'm going to use here.
You're in global ADS.
Sir?
You're in global ADS.
Well, right, so I mean, what's the right thing to say? Let's think about the theory defined on when boundary is a compact circle, finite volume.
it doesn't always necessarily follow that the spectrum of states is discrete. Sometimes there's just a continuous operator spectrum. Liouville theory has that, for instance. But these theories are a little bit pathological. They have infinite entropy at any finite temperature and so forth. So they're not what one usually expects. So I'm going to again assume discrete operator spectrum. It's still stronger than you need. We can go back and weaken this assumption later on, but it's a little bit technical and let's not get bogged down.
So you are thinking of modular invariance as a property of the spectrum, not necessarily.
It's a property of the.
So you don't have to talk about Euclidean CFD.
Yeah, I don't have to talk about Euclidean CFD. I mean, you can just take the spectrum, define a partition function out of it, and then the partition function has like some identity, right? So we don't even have to ever refer to Euclidean anything really if we don't want.
Although modular invariance is really only natural from that perspective.
Of course. Some things I'm going to be doing are unnatural. But they're still true. I think that's a point I want to just expand on a little bit. It's just true that if you want to deal with generic theories, with general theories that don't have any special property like supersymmetry or integrability or holomorphic factorization, there are no elegant identities, no elegant natural-looking equalities. One has to slice and dice them up in unnatural-looking ways. Okay. I don't want to claim that anything I'm doing today is going to be the most natural or the most elegant way to learn the facts that we're going to learn. But it will be a very complete and firm derivation of them. Which can maybe be improved. So the bounds that I'll talk about today can maybe be tightened. We certainly don't know of any cases that saturate. Everything we know, almost everything we know, undersaturates this bound parametrically, including string theory, by the way, and including anything with the massless or light fields in the bulk. And even the closest to saturation, these extremal CFT that Witten has talked about, undersaturate the bound by a factor of 2. So it may really be that this bound can be improved. And the fact that the derivation is unnatural suggests that maybe it can. But so we'll see. I'm glad you made that comment, because it's a good thing to bring up. Okay. So about what I was going to say there. All right. So how do you know? So as a general matter, you know that there exist lots of states at high energies in two-dimensional CFT. How do you know? Well, you know because of Carney's formula. Which says that there are a lot of states. If C and C tilde, let's make a notation. So this is C, the left and right moving central charges. So let's make a notation. C total equals C plus C tilde. Okay. The high energies, the density of states, goes something like E to the, I forget the root, I think C total over 6 times the energy, something like that. So there are an enormous number of states. But it's only an asymptotic formula. So unfortunately, so it's only true at high energies. Unfortunately, it's not a formula that can ever be falsified at by looking at a finite number of energy levels. It's something which is only a statement about the behavior of infinite collections of energy levels lying at high energy. Okay. That's not what we want. You know, if we're an experimenter in a three-dimensional gravity theory, we don't want to have to keep doing experiments forever to test whether physics is true or not, or whether unitarity is true or not, or whether logic is true, whether mathematics is consistent. We don't want to have to do an infinite number of experiments. We'd like to find something like Cardan's formula, but something that we can test at finite energies, maybe very high energies, but still finite in principle. We'd like to be able to do that. So, what's the general philosophy? So the general philosophy is that Z of beta, or beta is 1 over is a Boltzmann's constant over the temperature. Okay. So Z of beta is the sum over levels of e to the negative beta e sub n. And modular invariance says that Z of beta equals Z of 4 pi squared over beta. It's actually weaker than full modular invariance, but let's just use that. That's a immediate consequence of that's just a statement of the invariance under the modular S transformation. Is there any extra chalk?
Yellow box is in front of you.
One more.
Ah, thanks. So what does Cardan's formula do? So Cardan's formula relates a high temperature, the high temperature limit, to the low temperature limit. So in this limit, this limit is beta goes to infinity, Z of beta is dominated by a single level, E sub naught, which is negative C total over 24. That's a state statement of conformal invariance, and the fact that the lowest operator dimension, so delta is always going to be operator dimension, is just zero, because by the state operator correspondence, we know that the lowest dimension operator is always the identity. And so the lowest energy state always corresponds to that. E naught is the shift, the general shift between operator dimensions and energy levels. But as we say, Cardan's formula is an asymptotic state that relates high temperature to low temperature limits. So we're going to take something called the medium temperature limit, which is going to do the same kind of thing as Cardan's formula, so what is the medium temperature limit? So let's write the partition function. Well, let's say beta, it's called beta equal to 2 pi e to the s, where s is some real variable. So if we write the partition function as a function of this variable, it has to be a purely even function of S. Looked at in that way, you can see that modular invariance generates an infinite series of identities on the derivatives of the partition function with respect to temperature at this special medium temperature corresponding to beta equals 2 pi. Because there are an infinite number of independent derivatives of this partition function with respect to S that vanish. So any odd derivative with respect to S has to vanish. So partial sub S to the n of z 2 pi e to the S equals 0 for n odd. So this is actually quite a lot of information. And unlike the regime described by Carty's formula, unlike that regime where a single energy level dominates and all the others are completely washed out, or they all contribute together the same amount, unlike that identity, the medium temperature limit describes a situation in which the various energy levels contribute a finite amount. They all contribute differently. The lowest levels contribute more, actually quite a lot more, but not infinitely more. So we can actually get the tractable information that allows us to compare and contrast contributions of energy levels and learn something about finite numbers of energy levels. Actually, Alex, could you lift the screen at this point? I'd like to use the other blackboards.
You're speaking to yourself?
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. So let's write it in terms of beta. It's somewhat easier. So in terms of beta, the medium temperature expansion, so n is nth order in the medium temperature expansion. So beta partial with respect to beta, that operator raised to the nth power at beta equals 2 pi has to equal 0. So that's our information we're going to use. And it turns out we don't even need all of these identities. We'll only need n equals 1 and 3 to learn something interesting. So let me first give us something to do with the spirit of the proof, where I don't separate out gravitational excitations from the rest of the spectrum. There's a refined version. I'll explain at the end where I do that. But first, let's get a little bit weaker bound that still gives us some non-trivial information. Okay. So how do we do this? So z of beta, as we saw, is equal to sum over n e to the minus en beta. Beta partial with respect to beta to the n has the form a sum over to the big N, or to the, I'll call it j, I guess, to the j is equal to some polynomial f sub j of e sub n times the exponential suppression. So that's easy to see. It's some specific polynomial. Now, the first thing you might try is to say, well, let's see what we can learn from just the j equals 1 identity. So
evaluated at beta equals 2 pi. So we're always going to evaluate there. That's the point we're interested in.
So we have all these identities for every odd j. So let's try just j equals 1. So let's write z high. So z of the low states, let's just make that just the identity. And z of the high states is all the others. N equals 1 to infinity of e to the minus
b sub n beta. So you certainly learned something interesting from the j equals 1 case. So j equals 1 just says that the average energy at beta equals 2 pi is equal to 0. So that means sum over the high states is equal to minus beta sub n is equal to e to the minus e naught 2 pi times c plus c tilde over 24. Okay. So it does tell you something about these levels. And the intuition is that if the energies are all too high, that this exponential suppression will just kill every term, and you won't be able to make up this. This is some finite piece that just depends on the central charge, and if these levels are too high, you won't be able to make them sum up to this. That's a good intuition, but you can't quite get there. You can't quite get where you need to go, because there could be degeneracies in these levels that could be as big as you want, or very closely spaced levels that could give you an effective degeneracy that was as big as you want, that could exponentially overwhelm the suppression and still satisfy this identity. Okay. But then you would say, wait a minute. If those degeneracies are so big, then what happens when I take the j equals 3 identity? So we'll have something which goes like e naught cubed over here. And then these levels, the high levels, sufficiently high levels, will be very important. They'll be even more important to this sum than they were to the j equals 1 sum. So if the degeneracies were big enough to satisfy this equality for j equals 1, they would be even bigger, even more big enough to satisfy the equality for j equals 3. And in fact, they would be too big. So that's the intuition. Now we'll make it precise. So we'll define a relative importance factor, I of e, which we'll just define as F3 of e over F1 of e. So it's just, what is the relative importance of a given state's contribution to the j equals 3 identity relative to its importance, relative to the importance of its contribution to the j equals 1 identity. So now, let's see how this goes. So beta, partial beta, to the 3 of z low over beta, partial beta, to the 1 of z low at beta equals 2 pi has to exactly equal beta, partial beta, to the 3 of z high over beta, partial beta, to the 1 of z high at beta equals 2 pi. That's just, again, a statement of modular invariance processed a little bit. Because, as we saw before, this is the negative of this, and this is the negative of this at beta equals 2 pi. So the ratios obviously have to agree. Questions on that?
And by the way, I'll just say what this is. This is
2 pi e squared minus 3 times 2 pi e plus 1. Pretty simple. So this side over here is just equal to relative importance factor of e naught, because it contains only one level. This side over here is equal to sum n equals 1 to infinity of I'll write it relative importance factor of E sub n times F1 of E sub n times the exponential over sum from m equals 1 to infinity, the same expression with the F1 and the exponential, but without the relative importance factor inserted. Okay, so the relative importance factor is just the ratio of F3 to F1. So I've just rewritten F3 as I1 times, as importance factor times F1. That's just rewriting the definition of the importance factor. But now you can probably see where this is going. If the energy levels, energy level 1 upwards, if they're all so big that this relative importance factor is bigger than this ratio here, then the equality can never be satisfied. So if E1, the lowest energy level, is so big that I of E1 is bigger than I of E0, or let's say if all of the E sub n's are bigger than I of E naught, but if I1 is bigger, then they all will be. That's easy to show. Then modular invariance has to be violated. So what are the roots of this equation? So I of E is equal to I of E naught when E is equal to E naught, or E is equal to E plus, where E plus is 3 over 2 pi minus E naught. Because this equality follows directly from modular invariance, right? So if all of these factors, right? Yeah, all of the okay. So for F. Okay, so it's a little bit of a technical thing, and I'll show you. But yes, so if this condition is true, so if I of E1 is bigger than I of E0, then it is true that all of these f's are also positive. Okay. Because, so I'll show you right now. So this is the larger of the two roots. E naught is always negative. So E sub plus is always the larger of the two roots, and the importance factor is an increasing function on the positive real side. So that means that, if I of E1 is larger than the largest positive root of this equation, then first of all of the i's, all of the i's are bigger than I of E naught. Okay, so this condition here is equivalent to, I of I of E sub n greater than I of E naught is equivalent to E1 greater than E plus, and then yeah, you can check that. F1 is just E.
f1 of e is just e. That's what, or 2 pi times e. And this number e plus is positive. So if all of the e sub n's are greater than e plus, then they're all positive. So f1 of e is obviously always positive. It's just a linear function. So this term is positive, this term is positive, and this term is positive and greater than this number here. So it follows directly that this equation can never be satisfied. Modulo invariance is violated. So what this proves any CFT satisfying our restrictions, which are not really very restrictive. In any CFT, there always exists a state other than the vacuum with E. With E less than 3 over 2 pi plus C total over 24. And then translated into a statement about operator dimensions, so there always exists an operator with operator dimension less than 3 over 2 pi plus C total over 12. Now, unfortunately, for C large enough, so if this number is bigger than 2, it's not an interesting bound at all. Because every CFT always has an operator dimension 2. It's called the stress tensor. Okay, so that doesn't tell you, it still tells you something. So let me just look up the numbers. I wrote them down. So it actually still tells you some interesting things. Truth be told, because there's still a bit of a range of central charge for which this bound is non-trivial. So let's call this number delta sub plus, and then this number here is e sub plus. So for C total less than, still a pretty big number, 18.24, the bound is non-trivial. In particular, by the way, this range does contain supersymmetric sigma models on Kolodi manifold. So it's a big enough range to contain some interesting theories. That's 18. C plus C tilde equals 18 is a sigma model on the Kolodi. So there are some interesting theories in that range, a lot of them. But in the last few minutes, I'm going to sketch out how you do better, how you show that for any central charge, there's always a primary operator that lies below this number, 3 over 2 pi plus C total over 12. Yeah.
Just a scale on a circle.
Sorry?
If you have just a scale on a circle.
Yeah, then it's under
x in the smallest scale.
It's under saturation. So it's smallest what?
It's below that bar.
Yeah, pretty much under saturated. For C equals 1, for instance, I think the lowest weight you can get is actually, it's not that far low. It's either 1/4 or 1/2, I forget. So when you make the circle, the best number comes at the self-dual radius. So the operator dimension of the, I can't remember if it's 1/4 or 1/2. But remember, 3 over 2 pi, so 3 over 2 pi. If it's 1/2, then I guess, if it's 1/2, then it's close to being saturated. 3 over 2 pi, is about 1/2. It's actually a little bit smaller. But I think, at any rate, there's no problem. It's a true theorem that's always true.
there's, you know, it's not going to be violated by C equals one or anything else. Yeah, I mean, this is, well, I can, if you like, I can, well, I don't have a wireless connection, so I can't call it Mathematica, but we can check it afterwards if you like. Okay, but so now, yeah, in the last few minutes, I'll just show you how you organize the proof that establishes the same fact for primary operators, not just general operators. So the stress tensor is the thing that always comes in at delta equals 2. The stress tensor is the thing that makes the bound uninteresting. From the point of view of the bulk, it's saying that there are always boundary metric excitations. So descendants of the identity are always corresponding to the bulk to metric excitations on the boundary of AES3, and they're not terribly interesting in and of themselves, because they're universal, they're always there. They don't really tell you about massive states in the bulk. So, but the point of doing this weaker calculation was just to show you how the general ideas work, and then they all go through pretty much unproblematically, but just technically more complicatedly for the proof for primaries. And by the way, we'll make one final assumption for the proof for primaries, just to simplify things, but we'll make a couple. So we'll assume that C and C tilde are both greater than 1. Okay. That's not a big assumption, you don't lose anything. For C less than 1, CFTs are completely classified. So you can just check individually in each case that the bound is satisfied, or you can say it's not an interesting range to talk about the boundary. But at any rate, to simplify our lives, let's assume C and C tilde are greater than 1, and let's also assume no chiral algebra. So there are no purely left or right moving operators in our theory other than the stress tensor. Again, we don't really lose anything by doing that. When there is a chiral algebra, you expect the bound actually to be better, to be sharper. And it's an interesting case to consider, but to simplify our lives, let's just do that. So under these assumptions, so it's a fact that for this situation, the partition function of the CFT decomposes in a way I'll write B of beta plus M of big M of beta Y of beta, where this, okay, so Y of beta is a sum over primaries of e to the minus beta operator dimension. M of beta is a function that dresses, that takes the partition function of a primary and of a non-trivial primary, so other than the identity. So a primary is not equal to the identity. But takes a primary other than the identity and dresses it up into a whole conformal family. So it's e to the minus beta over beta C plus C tilde, I'm sorry, e to the minus beta over 24 over 12 over eta I beta over 2 pi quantity squared, where eta is the Dedekind eta function. Dedekind eta function is something, Dedekind eta function is something different. Okay. So it's the simplest example of a conformal block. And this assumption that C and C tilde are greater than 1 and no chiral algebra means that the conformal block for the structure of the conformal block for every non-trivial primary is all the same. And then for this is the partition function for the conformal family of the identity, and it's just 1 minus e to the minus beta quantity squared times m of beta. And so now you can just go through the entire machinery of this proof again,
And you derive some, you define some new polynomials. They're just slightly different polynomials. So now we can say beta partial beta to the j of z to the z of beta at beta equals 2 pi has to equal 0 for j i once again. And now this can be expressed in terms of some slightly more complicated polynomials. J times 1 over eta I 1 squared times e sum over n of minus 2 pi delta sub n f sub j of delta sub n. So this is the contribution from the primaries. And then this bit down here, I'll call little b sub j. And that's the contribution from the descendants of the identity. And then these polynomials are just something else you can write out. I'll write the relevant ones. So f sub 1 of z is equal to 2 pi z, in this case minus a half, and then f sub 3 of z is 2 pi z quantity cubed minus 9 halves 2 pi z quantity squared plus 41 eighths plus 6 times r to 0, I'll define that, times 2 pi z, minus 17 sixths plus 3 r to 0. Little r to 0 is the ratio of the second derivative to the zeroth derivative of the Dedekind eta function at I, which is equal to negative 1/16 plus sum over n pi n squared over sinh squared pi n, and it's about 0.012058. So these are some specific polynomials. And again, we just define this relative importance factor. I of I of z is f sub 3 of z over f sub 1 of z. So it's the same, the structure of the proof is exactly the same. And then we define the k is going to be b sub 3 of e naught plus 12 over b sub 1 of e naught plus 12. So the exact same proof says that there must be some energy level e sub 1, not, you know, bigger than e sub 0, such that this importance factor of E sub 1 is less than this number k, which depends on E sub 0. And then, well, it doesn't have a closed form. It just says that, okay, so you can define, just define so if we define E sub plus, again, to be the largest root, so define this number E sub plus, delta sub plus, 2 to be the largest root of this equation. The bound is that E sub delta sub 1 is less than delta sub plus. So it's a general lower bound for CNC Kelby greater than 1 on the weight of the lowest primary above the identity. And it's delta sub plus is the root of some cubic equation. Depending on the total central charge.
Which equation?
Sorry?
Which equation are you talking about? The root of?
Let's see. Yes, oh, sorry. So I didn't quite write this out. This is I of z. So the equation is I of E plus 1/12 equals K, which is B sub 3 of E naught plus a 12 over E sub 1 for E naught plus a 12. And then B, I'm sorry, I rushed through this notation very quickly. I'm sorry, I didn't write what it was. So B, well, you don't even have to write the argument, but B sub J is just some universal constant. Basically 1 over eta sub a of I squared. I think that's it. 1 over eta of I squared times beta partial beta of B of beta evaluated at beta equals 2 pi. And then B has E naught in it. Because that's the graph, the Casimir hybrid. Okay, so I can write that out if you like.
Anyway, so those are they only depend on the central charge.
Only depends on the central charge. That's right. Mm-hmm. So then you can you can expand this bound at large central charge, but of course, it's only if each order in the expansion is the best bound at that order that the next order has any significance. So you might as well only write the first couple of orders. So at large C total, delta C plus is indeed equal to C total over 12 plus some number order 2 to the 0 piece plus order C total to the minus 1, which I didn't compute. This number is extremely close, numerically almost equal to 3 over 2 pi. So it's almost the same bound, and it's slightly bigger.
I should say it's very close to and slightly bigger than. So, and then you can again verify you manipulating the polynomial, but it's a fact. So it's a fact that delta plus is always bigger than C total over 12 plus 3 over 2 pi, but only very slightly bigger. So for C and C tilde greater than 1, only very slightly bigger. Smaller. Excuse me. So the bound is actually sharper than the simple linear bound. But it's still very close to it. So CT over 12 plus 3 over 2 pi plus something like 0.03. So it's very well approximated by the simple linear bound, and so there you go. So what's the conclusion? I'm basically out of time, so I'd like to wrap up.
You've got your things in the opposite.
I think that's what I mean.
Good question, by the way. So in the Hagedorn temperature, where would it be? Or
the Hagedorn temperature? Hagedorn temperature is a temperature of a target space.
Yeah, okay. So what I should say, it's a place where the...
C, right?
C divided by what?
Well, you wrote that it was C over 6 divided by the energy.
Well, C total. Oh, you're right. So if C is equal to C tilde, then yeah. So that it... Well, I mean, it's not a temperature. It's just that it's... So what's the... So the energy... So the lower bound on the energy of the first state is what? Is C tilde... this is C total over 24 plus 3 over 2 pi, which is, yeah, for C equals C tilde, that's C over 12 plus 3 over 2 pi. Go.
The reason I'm asking is that is it important that this point 1 over 2 beta equals 1 over 2 pi is within the radius of convergence of your high?
Oh, the radius is infinite. I should have said that at the beginning. That's one thing the Cardy's formula tells you. The level density increases as the square root of the energy, so that means it increases slower than any geometric function.
Okay, so your e to the minus e n beta.
That always converts. So if you write in if you write it as an integral over a level density, you can see that it converges. Yeah, that's a good. Thank you for reminding me about that. It is an issue, by the way. This is what I was asking about earlier. It is an issue. The rate of convergence is an issue when you try to do this sort of trick for the four-point function. So for the four, there's some analogous trick for four-point functions, and again you go to the self-dual point, which is the square where the operators are inserted at the square. But that's exactly the radius of convergence. You can sort of subtract off the leading singularity if you know enough about the conformal blocks. And in cases where you do know them, you can do it explicitly and you can learn something. But without the explicit form of the conformal blocks for the four-point function, you can't quite make this trick go through. I should say that there was a paper in last July by Rattazzi and collaborators, which does a similar trick in four dimensions for four-point functions. Not for the lowest operator in general, but for the weight of the lowest operator that occurs in a given OPE. And there, they do
use the conformal blocks. But the conformal blocks are much smaller in four dimensions because the conformal algebra is much smaller. So it's the closed form for the conformal blocks is actually known in four dimensions as of relatively recently, but it is known. In two dimensions, the conformal blocks are a lot bigger, much bigger. So on the one hand, it means the condition of being primary is much stronger, so you can learn a lot more. But on the other hand, it means that the conformal blocks are harder to write down explicitly. And I believe the state of the art is they're still not known explicitly in the general case. Question?
If you have n equal to 2, can you show that you're a constant Carroll family?
Sorry, for like 2 comma 2 supersymmetry or something, can you show a bound on the lowest chiral primary? So there's some work by Gukov and Moore and someone else, I forget who, work on this problem. But if I remember correctly, they also assume some sort of holomorphic factorization. So it's I think it's still not quite general. Yeah, I think if you a general statement is if you include a larger chiral algebra, like, I mean, n equals 2 supersymmetry is a great chiral algebra to include. It's one of the most interesting ones. You can probably extract a lot more refined information about things like, right. So I mean, chiral primaries are the primaries of the full chiral algebra of n equals 2. So and that would be the sort of thing you could do, and then you just need. I don't know. Are the conformal blocks known in that case? Well, the conformal blocks.
There's something known, but not sure.
But at least the conformal blocks for the partition function are known, obviously, in that case. They're simple. So you can still do this sort of trick and derive a bound on the way to the lowest chiral primary in n equals 2 theory.
You haven't done
that? No, I haven't done anything other than this. There's another type of chiral algebra which is interesting, which is just a current algebra symmetry. Now, in that case, this sort of decomposition, you can do this sort of decomposition where,
So you don't have supersymmetry. At least, yeah, I was thinking about it.
No assumption supersymmetry, no.
No, but if there would be from space-time fermions, what would happen?
Oh, right, good question. So, you have to generalize the condition of Mind-Blown variance, but I think this is pretty well understood. There's some, I guess, subgroup of the Mind-Blown group, some index 2 subgroup of the Mind-Blown group or something, where, tau goes to tau plus 2.
The reason I'm asking is that for the superstring, that the genus 1 partition sum is 0.
No, that's different. That's the ghosts are responsible for that. That never happens in a unitary symmetry. So the super ghosts are responsible. The Fedeyev-Popov and super ghosts. there's still identities like that you can derive.
And now there is this abstruse whatever this thing that even in light cone gauge if you're 0.
Yeah, but in light cone gauge you put in a minus sign explicitly. It's not a partition function in the usual sense. It's not a thermal partition function.
Right. No, so what you do, you take each of the individual terms and then
Right. So there are other modular invariant objects whose modular transformations you can do this sort of manipulation with at the medium temperature point and derive lower bounds on the mass of the lightest non-like
rather specific, right? Yeah. If I have a boundary condition for my fermions along the circle,
yes,
that would not modular transform to a thermal boundary condition.
Right.
You would have to redo your game.
Right. You also want the state operator correspondence for light cone gauge. So the
no, I'm not talking about light cone gauge. Just saying.
Oh, for
very general.
For NSR.
If I have, yeah.
Right, but space-time fermions are never enter a unitary CFG in the usual sense. World shape fermions do, but space-time fermions,
But here you've excluded also, at least you've gone to an even fermion section world shape.
Right, so you can relax that by restricting to modular invariance over an index 2 subgroup of the modular group that's generated by the S transformation and T squared.
where, but the technical details of your proof would change.
They don't change because the S transformation is still present.
But the positivity of certain numbers, is that still there?
If you have space number,
you will see.
Well, okay, but there are different cases to consider. Yeah, so if you have, and usually in a unitary CFT, you can have world sheet fermions, but you GSO project onto total even world sheet fermion.
Yes,
right. If you don't want to do that, then you have to redo things slightly, and I don't know what happens in that case. So supersymmetry does require some modifications. That's one of the reasons I haven't, that sort of details that even I haven't fun there. Yeah.
Probably a stupid question, but can't you start out with the UV theory, tensor product with, let's say, C equal to max?
Can't you start with the which theory?
With UV theory.
Lugal theory violates, yeah.
Exactly, but can you tensor product it with the regular, let's say, some U1 CFT mod by one, such as remaining the speeds expecting?
Wait, sorry, you want to take Lugal theory, put it together with a U, with a pure, with a C equals one, and then mod out by U1?
Mod by one in such a way that leaves you with a discrete spectrum.
No, you can't do that. If you mod by U1, you just get rid of the U1 piece and you're left with Lugal theory. You can. There's no easy way, no trick. There's no trick to get Lugal theory to have a discrete spectrum. It doesn't have a discrete spectrum. It's a continuous spectrum. That's part of what Lugal theory is all about. More questions? Yeah. So I've gone over time, but I wanted to say I think there are a lot of interesting things to be done. There is now a technical machinery that turns quantum gravity into a fully mature subject where we can't just necessarily blab out whatever, you know, kooky theory happens to pop into our heads anymore. We have some real theoretical constraints, model-independent constraints to deal with. And I think that's, we should all view that as a very fruitful development.
Even in three dimension, what all of this has to do with the sympathetic flashbacks?
Oh, right. So thank you for asking. I mean, so there are many quantum gravity theories in flat space that can be approached as limits of quantum gravity theories in ADS. Okay. In fact, all the ones we know that can be approached as limits can be approached in limits in several ways. As limits of ADS.
Would you expect C to go to infinity? Then
no, the bound is still interesting. The bound is still interesting. No, in fact, that's where it's most robust. So I didn't have time to translate this back into gravitational language. Let me just translate it back into Bloch language very quickly. This relationship says that there always exists a massive state in the bulk. So for finite ADS radius, there always exists a massive state in the bulk with the mass less than 1 over 4 g Newton plus order 1 over, I think, g Newton, no, order 1 over L ADS. Right, so in the limit of large central charge, this exactly goes to the mass of the BTZ of the lowest BTZ black hole. So it's still quite a non-empty. It's still quite a non-empty constraint. It tells you that if you take 3D gravity and couple it to massive matter, maybe put the matter a little bit above, put the physical mass of the matter a little bit above the Planck scale. It says that any loop corrections coming from the mass of matter in any UV completable theory can never renormalize the mass of the lowest BTZ black hole upwards in a consistent UV complete theory in asymptotically flat or almost asymptotically flat space with a slightly negative cosmological density. Now that's a very
When you talk about the mass, at some level it's already it's an asymptotic property, so it lifts, at least since you can define it in this, you have a sense of gone to the boundary. You understand what I'm trying to say? Is that, that this thing, that this this notion of mass is actually defined in your CFT. It's defined in, asymptotically.
Right.
So whatever happens in the bulk is being sort of, yeah.
That's
right. It's simply the fact that, that anything that happens there, energy, is a constraint. At least there's a local Hamiltonian constraint and it tells you that things can be pushed at boundary.
Is it something like that? Yeah. That's right. I mean, I can't quite prove that it applies to all theories in asymptotically flat space, because there may be theories in asymptotically flat space that can't be obtained as limits of AES theories. In fact, there are many such theories, like in particular the weakly coupled periodic string, where we don't know how to obtain them as limits of AES theories. Maybe they can't be. So it's possible that there are cases where this boundary does not apply in flat space, in three-dimensional flat space. So I don't want to overclaim here. This is not a theorem about flat space in general, but it is a theorem about, it is a theorem which is still non-trivial in the flat space limit of AES. Yeah.
How do you measure the mass with L Planck?
Well, G Newton is L Planck in three dimensions.
So this is your scale to measure with respect to the mass. And what is the lowest BTZ mass with respect to L Planck?
1/4 G Newton. There are different ways of translating G Newton into L Planck. There are different things that people mean by L Planck, so that's why I'm using G Newton instead of L Planck. So L Planck is a little bit more convention dependent than G Newton. Everyone means the same thing by G Newton. So I'm just going to express it in terms of G Newton. But in terms of some people say that G Newton is L Planck, some people say it's pi L Planck, some people say it's 2 L Planck.
Dimensionless.
There's nothing dimensionless, this is a mass. It's a mass. Mass of the lowest state is less than 1/4 G Newton. There's no dimensionless anything set to zero. There's no dimensionless constant set to one. The mass has dimensions of mass, and 1/2 G Newton
has I expect you to measure the mass in Planck's
step. But I'm not sure what you mean by measure.
Given a
bound in
flat space.
1/2 G Newton is the Planck. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So this is a dimension.
It depends what you set to 1. If you set G Newton to 1, then the mass is 1/4.
This is not a meaningful thing.
It's 1/4. It's 1/4. 1/4. The mass of the lowest state is always less than 1/4 in Planck units. Which happens to be the mass of the BTZ black hole, which is a more convention-independent thing to say. And by the way, that was an easy convention to match because Witten basically did all the work, because he says that his lower bound is 1/2 the mass of the BTZ black hole. So it's very clear that in CFT, my lower bound is twice his. So my lower bound is the mass of the BTZ black hole at large central times. That's easy. So I have basically zero uncertainty about those conventions. Because it's clear that Witten's paper would not have worked if he'd gotten a numerical factor wrong. The entropies, the numerical entropies he calculated, which agreed to, you know, less than a percent error, would have been hugely off by factors of, you know, tens of thousands. So it's clear that that coefficient is correct. Further questions?
Good, so let's see you.